Okay. Very quickly, is there anybody that needs outline that we're on, which is page 15, 16. I've got two pages left. I've got two copies left if somebody wants one. So I didn't get one from last week. Okay. No, this is a brand new one from last week. Yes, I have one more. Okay. And if you have that sheet that I just passed out, I should kind of look to see where we're at on there. Help. We got down through last week. Last week we got down through Exodus 19, which is down to point C on your page 15. So that's kind of where we're picking up, is at point C tonight. And we noticed last week that there was a change in our study that we're looking at right now. You can see the title of it is God's Big Tent, Moses, the Law, and the Tabernacle. Moses, Law, and the Tabernacle, that's the subtopic, but the larger one, God's Big Tent. The reason we call it that is because I think this is one of the things that a lot of us fail to realize. We look at the law, we see that the law is a set of requirements that God has for the life of these people. But one of the other things that we miss in there is that the law really tied the people of Israel to a location, that is the tabernacle or the temple. And the law set down what these people had to do to be able to come to God. And that is really important, I think, for us moving on. Maybe as a means of contrast, to appreciate the access we have to God compared to where Israel was and during their 1,500 years.
So, however, Israel's access was better than it had ever been.
Pardon me?
Israel's access was better than it had been prior, because
they had a place that they could go, but if you remember, prior to this, God was showing up and personally talking and meeting with different people at different occasions, and now all of a sudden they've got all these hoops that they have to jump through to come into God's presence. So there's a place they know that they can come and find God, but in order to do so, there's a number of steps that they have to take to be able to be suitable. And so what we're going to do tonight, and I said this last week, what we're going to do tonight is we're really going to go over to the book of Leviticus. So we're not going to, in one night, I have not gone back to see how long it took us to work through Leviticus last time we did this. But I want to look at the fact that the law, point C there, that the law defined the life of the people of Israel, and it did this in two chief ways. How they could relate to and access God. So that's the first thing that the law regulated, their relationship and access to God. And second of all, how they could experience benefits from God. Now that really has to do with the dispensation, how they could get those benefits. So the first thing we're going to look at, point one, is that it regulated their ability to come to God. It did this by laws of the tabernacle, and later what we would call the temple, built by Solomon. And this involved priests, sacrifice, and offerings. So if you have your Bibles, you can see where the scriptures are. We're going to look. We're going to be in Leviticus chapter 8. And we're going to look at a series of statements here about getting the priests ready. These are the men, and this is everything that they had to do to be able to come into the presence of God. And so in Leviticus chapter 8, verse 1, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take Aaron and his sons with him, and the garments, and the anointing oil, and the bowl, and the sin offering, and the two rams, and the basket of unleavened bread, and assemble all the congregation at the doorway of the tent of meeting. So, tent of meeting being the tabernacle, where they met, and it's called that because this is where they met with God. And Moses did just as the Lord commanded him when the congregation was assembled at the door of the tent of meeting. And Moses said to the congregation, "This is the thing which the Lord has commanded to do." Then Moses and Aaron and his sons came near, and they washed them with water. So in front of everybody, they washed these people. There's some question about whether they're doing that using this large basin that was set out in front of there, or whether they're pouring the water on them externally, separate from that. But so first of all, it involves a washing. So they have to go through a washing in this way. Secondly, in verse 7 through 9, and he put the tunic on him. So now they're going to dress him. So first of all, you kind of understand this. You wash and then you get dressed. So that's what they do. They wash Aaron and his sons, and then they put the tunic on him. Your tunic is, best way to put it, describe a tunic for you, it's your undershirt. That's what a tunic was. And tunics usually came down to your knees. So they were a long work shirt that people wore under their outer garments. So they're putting on this long undergarment work shirt, as it were. I remember everybody, they didn't have short shirts because nobody wears pants, okay? Everybody wears robes, men and women alike. And so they put a tunic on him, and then they girded him with the sash and clothed him then with the robe, and then they put the ephod on him. The ephod is like an apron. It's a sleeveless apron that goes on over the top of the robe. And then they girded him with the artistic band. So after that, so he's got a sash on over this, then he's got the robe on, then he's got this ephod, this apron, and then around this he's got another, shall we say, a belt. They call it girded him with the artistic band of the ephod, with which he tied it to him. So this is the way they tie it up. Think of what you tie a robe with. And then they placed the breast piece on him. Remember, the breast piece was made out of metal and fabric, and it had places where there were different jewels set in there, one representative for each one of the tribes of Israel. And in the breast piece, so apparently there's a pocket in there. This is what we think. But we think that there's apparently a pocket behind this breast piece. And in that pocket, then, they put the Urim and the Thummim, which, you want to know what those are? Nobody knows. Sometimes they think that the words meant lights, and there's another thing. Some people have wondered if they were like a pair of stones that they would drop on the ground to determine the will of God. It is interesting if that's the case. Many cultures, in fact, Peg was just watching a little clip from a movie yesterday, that in many cultures, people use something similar to dice or bones, and they cast them on the ground to determine future events. It wouldn't be surprising, if that's what it was, that all these other cultures have modeled what God did. Remember, Satan hasn't come up with the original idea in his life. He's always trying to copy God. But this is what they're doing, and we do know that that's what they were for. In fact, just last night or the day before, Peg and I were reading in 1 Samuel, and it talks about Saul, remember, after Samuel's gone, after Samuel is dead, that Saul's trying to determine whether he's going to be successful in war, and he doesn't get any response from the Urim and the Thummim. We're trying to use them, and they won't tell us anything. So, however they worked. And then they placed a turban on his head. And you've probably seen pictures. That's a turban. And on the turban at its front, he placed the golden plate and then the holy crown, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. And then in verse 10, then they've got anointing oil that they place on him in here. And then if you go down to verse 14, after they're all dressed, then he brought the bull of the sin offering, and Aaron and his sons laid their hands on the head of the bull of the sin offering. There was significance. I think you probably can get this. What was the significance when you had an offering of you laying your hands on the head of the animal that was going to be offered? Yeah. Yeah. So you're making a connection between you and this animal, okay? Exactly, an identification. So they brought the bull of sin offering. Aaron and his sons laid their hands on the head of the bull of the sin offering. Next, Moses slaughtered it, and he took the blood with his finger, and he put it around the horns of the altar and purified the altar. Then he poured out the rest of the blood at the base of the altar and consecrated. Remember, consecrated, I don't know why they chose to use this word in English, because all the word means is to make holy or to set apart. It's a verb form of the word holy. consecrated it to make atonement or a covering for it. And he also took all the fat that was on the entrails and the lobe of the liver and the two kidneys and their fat and offered them up in smoke and all of this. And he burned that outside the camp. And then, I was trying to find the next part of this in here, if we just keep eating this. Oh, they eat. If you go on down there, verse 31, it tells us that then Moses said to Aaron, and his sons boil the flesh at the door of the tent of meeting and eat it where and eat it there together with the bread which is in the basket. So part of this is also, and this was really very common again, that when they took, here, this is what I wanted to catch that I don't have listed on here. Verse 23 says, and Moses slaughtered this. Now this is another, this is the ram, okay, male sheep. Put the blood on the lobe of Aaron's right ear, on the thumb of his right hand, and on the big toe of his right foot. I've heard different explanations of the significance of the lobe and this. And the right side normally was the side of favor. Benjamin is Ben, son, Yamin, right hand, son of my favor. Okay, so you got, this is the son of my favor here. Show my favor on him. If I have another son, he's on my left hand. He doesn't get the favor that the Benjamin does. Okay, that's what. So the right hand was the fellowship. That's why God grants us to sit, and the Father grants the Son to sit at His right hand. That's why the Son grants us to sit with them at His right hand, because the right hand is the place of privilege. And so there's some likelihood that the right side, all of this has to do with recognizing privilege in what God is doing. In this process, but they eat some of this, and then it tells us, beginning in verse 33, and you shall, Moses gives them these instructions, God gives them through Moses to Aaron and his sons, you shall not go outside the doorway of the tent of meeting for 7 days until the day that the period of your ordination is fulfilled, for he will ordain you through those 7 days. So when they go through this initiatory act, then Aaron and his sons have to stay in that tent for 7 days. So they're not moving about outside doing different things. They're not going home at night. They're spending 7 days in there. And this was for the purpose of, it says, ordaining this, setting this in place, this ordination, literally to appoint him to this. So the first thing that we're seeing here in with point number one that we have listed here is that these things, all of this exemplifies that the priests were being set apart with service through ritual. Obviously, putting blood on a person's ear and their thumb and hand and slaying it, none of that actually physically changes anything, but it's ritual for the purpose of demonstrating that God's doing something special with these people. Then, once they're set in order, then there are sacrifices that they're supposed to offer. So the priests are offered to command to offer sacrifices. In verse 2 of chapter 9, and he said to Aaron, take for yourselves a calf, a bull for a sin offering, and a ram for a burnt offering. Doing without effect and offer them before the Lord. And then the sons of Israel, then to the sons of Israel, you shall speak saying, take a male goat for a sin offering, and a calf and a lamb, both 1 year old without defect for a burnt offering. And then an ox and a ram for a peace offering, the sacrifice to the Lord, and a grain offering mixed with oil, for today the Lord shall appear to you. So God had a set of offerings here, sin offering, a burnt offering, peace offering, a grain offering. All of these, looking at all of these aspects of their relationship, what God was going to do in terms of taking away their sin, of their prayers going up in the burnt offering, of an offering that was there to establish peace between they and God. And the grain offering implying that God provides them the benefit of being able to eat, okay? All of these, but you notice how, did you see the order, though? It starts with the sin offering. God's first got to address the sin, then has to address, God looks at it, first of all, address your sin, then your ability to communicate, then there's peace, and then there's prosperity. And you see that? Sin, communication, peace, prosperity. And that's what each one of these offerings, the way this is kind of going through this. Because this is what God's going to be showing these people. I'm promising you under the law prosperity, but you have to deal with your sin first. And that's going to be taking place there. Come to chapter 10 and we have an interruption in all of this Levitical law. We call it Levitical law because it's law for the Levites and then what the people were supposed to do with respect to them. And in chapter 10, we have this matter where Aaron has four sons and his two sons that are priests, two of those, Nadab and Abihu in verse 1, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans and after putting fire in them, placed incense on it and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded. And fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them. That is, it burns them completely up and they died before the Lord. And there's a number of things that happen. They're supposed to take the bodies outside. He tells Aaron, you're not supposed to take off your robes. You're not supposed to grieve over these guys. There's a number of things that God tells them to do. Now, there's one very important statement. If you look back in chapter 9 at verse 6, those offerings that God indicates that they were to offer, it says in verse 6 of chapter 9, and Moses said, this is the thing which the Lord has commanded you to do, that the glory of the Lord might be seen by you. Or your Bibles probably say, may appear to you. But literally, it's written in such a way, it's a might be seen. You get the privilege of actually being able to see God's glory. And that tells you what this ritual was about. It's about having God in your presence. Now think about that. People come up to this building, and people today know this is a church because they've seen churches here. If you maybe were coming from China, where they don't have churches like this, they might roll up the street, and they might not know that this is different than any other building on the street. They might not know. And actually, this isn't a church. It's a building where the church meets properly. But we say that because a lot of people had tents and structures. But what was special about the tabernacle and the temple through Israel's history? God was present. There was a pillar of smoke that represented God's presence there at that tabernacle and with these people. And it's present all during this time. And these people get to, but they take it for granted. You see, if we walked up there, people walked up and people drove around, they go, you ever notice top First Baptist Church there? They've always got that pillar of cloud that's hanging right above the building. It can be a clear day and there's not another cloud in the sky and there's always that one cloud, not 1,000 feet up, but somewhere that's sticking up as a pillar right over the top of that. You'd, after a while, begin to think, that's really unusual. But it was there as part of the glory of God, and it's something that Israel actually over time took for granted. This unusual event that was there every day, eventually they just kind of take it for granted, and they don't think anything special about it. And yet it should have stood there, and their kids should have been going, Mommy, Daddy, why is that cloud always over the top of that tent? And then when they build the temple, why is that cloud there at the temple? Why is it there? It was there for a special purpose. But God commanded that his presence would be there. Now when Nadab and Abihu in chapter 10 go in, it says at the very end of verse 1 that the fire they took in was fire which God had not commanded them. And I believe that this is the most important answer. There's a lot of people who try to figure out what was this strange fire that they offered in this context. And we could say strange fire. These are some of the things that have been suggested. Strange fire could have involved the violation of any of the above. And I think it is because he said that these were the things they commanded. So they had these offerings that they were supposed to be offering before the Lord. And they come in and offer an offering that God hasn't commanded. They come in and bring fire God hasn't asked them to bring. They do something on their own. And we'd say, well, I mean, why is that so bad? They took some initiative. God didn't ask for it. That's the problem. And God was trying to show them, this is the law. You take it seriously. It's a life or death matter. This isn't just a little Sunday stroll out here. This is serious business, this law. Yeah, Cain took an offering that God had not commanded and took it lightly. That, I think, is the best explanation of this passage. Other people have said that I'm just going to go through and read my note here. Strange fire could have involved the violation of any of the above. In addition, could have come at a different time, that they brought it at a time God had not commanded, because there were times they were supposed to do this and times they weren't. Or it may have violated a rule against drinking wine or strong drink when coming before God, that he tells them, actually, down in verse 9 of chapter 10, that there was a thing. Strange fire probably, though, really involved that they didn't maintain the distinction between the holy and the profane or the common. It says that again in the same context, chapter 10 and verses 10 and 11. That they did not make a distinction before the holy and the profane, between the unclean and the clean. And I would say right there, the clean and the unclean means that this fire that they offered involved something that was unclean. He also, because he tells them, makes the statement about not drinking. He has to remind them, drink no wine or strong drink. They probably also was a problem when these guys went in there, that they had actually drunk something that they were not supposed to drink before going into the presence. So I believe chapter 10, verses 9, 10, 11, the very fact that God has to specifically remind Aaron and his two remaining sons what they're to do, I think that's a reminder, points out this is where they violated the problem. This is where the strange fire came in, because they violated these principles. They'd offered something that was, they didn't respect between the clean and the unclean, which probably meant that they handled something they weren't supposed to handle, and so as a result that they're unclean when they go in. Okay, but this is important. The whole issue of strange fire in chapter 10, when everybody, we always try to figure out what the strange fire is, and I think we have at least a good explanation in verses 9, 10, and 11 here, that it has to do that it was not what God asked over there in chapter 9 we just looked at, and so they're violating this according to verses 9, 10, and 11. The significance of all of that, again, is to remind us God took all this very seriously. He was not messing around. He just doesn't say, Aaron, tell your boys, cut it out. God's saying, listen, I'm going to take care of this. And God initiates it and burns up these two sons of Aaron, that teach and makes them take very seriously what is happening at this point on. Okay. Now, we go down to chapter 11, Leviticus chapter 11, and let's look at some matters that the law also caused this separation in, with these people, by setting down laws regarding personal cleanliness, washings, eating, and sacrifice. And so in chapter 11, there's a lot of laws laid down about what they could eat and what they couldn't eat. And I'm not going to have you go over there, but in Ephesians chapter 2, when Paul refers to the law in Ephesians 2, he talks about, let's see, and I'm not going to get it quite right, but it's commandments in the form of dogma, or dogmas in the form of commandments. And I think Jim was actually, you were talking about dogmas 2 or 3 weeks ago in the adult Sunday school class. And the significance of what a dogma was is a dogma is a rule that's set down that doesn't have, shall we say, a natural, there's not a naturalness to it. I mean, it's not like, oh, that makes complete perfect sense. It's just I mean, we would say killing somebody to us naturally seems wrong. Most of us would say that. Granted, there may be some cultures that they don't think that. But naturally, we think generally killing another person seems naturally wrong. Okay. But having said that, there were some things that God imposed in the law that were dogmas, that they were rules that God gave, that you couldn't have said, I can't eat, how many of you like clams? I like clams. Okay, I should ask this one. How many of you like shrimp? Okay, see, I got a lot more hands with the shrimp. Okay, my wife and my daughters like shrimp. I'm not a big shrimp fan. But Israel couldn't eat shrimp. Israel couldn't eat crab. Israel couldn't eat lobster. Israel couldn't eat clams. Israel couldn't eat pork. I like beef, but you know what? I love pork better. You know, I think of Babe. Pork's a nice, sweet meat. Pork tastes generally, has a little bit better flavor in some respects than beef does. But Israel couldn't eat that. Why? Because God designated them as unclean. Why did he designate them as unclean? See, I've read books years before, and I've told you this. I've read books many years ago when I was growing up. Or I should say, my parents read a book, and we got to listen to some of it, where there was a man that tried to say God didn't want Israel to eat pork because they didn't know how to cook it properly. And so they'd all get trichinosis. Well, the problem with that is these people weren't idiots. And when Peter comes along in the New Testament, God now tells him that nothing is to be abstained from. You don't abstain from any food today for religious purposes. Now all of a sudden, do they know how to cook pork and they didn't know how to do it 1,500 years earlier? No. God tells us, no, this is Leviticus 11, Leviticus chapter 11, and look with me down in verse 44. For I am the Lord your God. You shall make yourselves holy, consecrate, that's the word you have there, but to make holy, and be holy, for I am holy. And you shall not make yourselves unclean with any of the swarming things that swarm on the ground. How many of you remember when the Bells were here several years ago and they brought dried caterpillars in here? And Joseph Dahlke and I each got to eat part of a dried caterpillar. Okay? And I thought it tasted kind of nutty. I could understand why the Bells kids, why they all like those caterpillars. And so when their parents come, they always say, bring us upani, bring us upani, because they like them, because they grew up eating them in Africa. But that, see, if you were under law, you couldn't eat caterpillars. Okay? Begins the law. For I am the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt to be your God, and you shall be holy, for I am holy. And this is the law regarding the animal, the bird, every living thing that moves in the water, and everything that swarms in the sea. Here's the purpose, verse 47. To make a difference, a distinction, to make a difference between the unclean and the clean, between the edible creature and the creature which is not to be eaten. So God says, the reason I'm giving you this law is to make you different. That was the purpose of this. People say, their neighbors would go, we're having this big slaughter of the pig. How come you guys aren't over here eating pork with us? We don't eat pork. Why? Because our God wants us to be different. Your God wants you to be, and just think, they could potentially, had they actually functioned those ways, they could potentially have actually told them about their God, if they would have done these things right. So first of all, cleanliness with regard to what they eat. Chapter 12 has cleanliness with regard to giving birth. You mothers can be really happy you weren't a Jew under the law, because if you gave birth to a male child, you couldn't go to the temple for a month. And if you had a girl, you couldn't go to the temple for 2 months. Why? Because girls make you more unclean? Well, from a ceremonial point of view, they were unclean. Is there something naturally more unclean about girls than boys? No. In fact, I think it was the old story was, what are little boys made of? Snips and snails and puppy dog tails. You know, the boys were always kind of, you know, I always consider the boys kind of the roustabout, grungy, dirty kids. But in reality, there were cleanliness rules as you go through chapter 12 about what the mother had to do in giving birth and how long she was considered to be unclean. How long she had to stay away from the temple, from the sanctuary, the holy, all that means is from the holy place. Then in Leviticus chapters 13 through 15, we have matters of diseases. We're not going to go through all those, but we have these. These involve psoriasis, eczema, fungus, okay, boils, burns, infections, leprosy, mold in your house or in your pottery and stuff like that. You might have a house, if you ended up getting mold in a house, this has become a problem in some places in the United States where people have built housing because they didn't build them properly or they're not vented right. They have mold problems. You know what you did with those houses according to the law? You had to tear them completely down. You didn't bring in a crew that sprayed chemicals down and did all this work. They just tore them down. They were required by the law of God to tear down a house that had mold like that in it. And so those are just some examples in chapters 13 through 15 here of God's requirements of how these people were to be clean. It also revolved certain emissions that people had from wounds and different things like that, and emissions relating to sex and natural cycle for women and all of those things. And all of those are addressed in those chapters. And there was matters of cleanliness that God required of these people. Then you turn over to chapter 18. And we skip over 16 and 17 because 16 and 17 are talking to us about the Day of Atonement and setting all of that up. And God sets down, and the significance of the Day of Atonement was it was the time of year that God made a cleansing one time a year for the temple so that he would continue residing. So it's not like every day there's sacrifices going on, but once a year, the whole group of people come together, and the whole group of people there in the Day of Atonement get together through this act that God might stay in their midst for another year. And it was a very big deal. Now, Passover is a big celebration for Israel because it was a liberation. But one of my professors, when I was in seminary, his wife was an executive. His wife was an executive secretary at Intel, and her boss was a Jew, and he had to leave early on Fridays so that he could be home by sundown because he was actually an Orthodox Jew, and he goes down, and when Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement, came, she actually says to him, "Happy Yom Kippur," and he turned around and says to her, "Yom Kippur is not a happy day for a Jew. It is a very sad and very solemn day because it was the day that made the nation face their sinfulness and the fact that their sins had to be covered, had to be atoned for another year for God to remain with them." That guy actually had a fairly good handle on, as a Jew, what the purpose of the Day of Atonement was for the people of Israel in the Old Testament. And it was a very solemn day compared to the Passover, which was a day to celebrate and rehearse your history with your children and God's deliverance and rescue from Egypt. They took the Day of Atonement with a great deal of seriousness. But we turn from there over to chapter 18. And we get to chapter 18, and he's going to give them a lot of instructions. We're not going to read through these, but instructions about it's sexual matters. It's plain and simple is what it's about. But it's interpersonal relationships, and he's trying to tell them that what they're going to do, he says in verse 3, "You shall not do what is done in the land of Egypt where you live, nor shall you do what is done in the land of Canaan where I am bringing you. You shall not walk in their statutes." So God's saying, you're going to be different in the way that you relate to one another. And he goes through there and you can read through in the details. But again, God's making differences. He's making differences in what they eat, differences in the way they treat the whole matter of birth, differences in the way he treats diseases and funguses, difference in the way they have their interpersonal relationships. Chapter 19 should seem very obvious to us, but if you look with me at verse 1, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the congregation of the sons of Israel and say to them, 'You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy, and every one of you shall reverence his mother and father. You shall keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord. Do not turn to idols or make for yourselves molten gods. I am the Lord.'" And then he says, "When you offer a sacrifice of peace offerings, there's a way that it was supposed to be done." But he tells them, as he kind of goes through this in these chapters, again, reminding them, "I want you to have a proper relationship to your parents, a proper relationship to me, and I do not want you involved in idolatry." Has to go back and remind them again. We have a chapter division here, but one of the reasons that is significant about honoring your parents and about not having idols and about having the proper sacrifice is because he just got done talking about these interpersonal relationships in chapter 18. And in reality, in Egypt and in Canaan, those things were all tied together. Parents and those relationships, I mean, he says in there, not your father and not with your mother and your sister and so on and so forth. And he says all these things because these were issues in these other places. And the idolatry was directly tied to this immorality in both Egypt and there. So even though we have a chapter division, I hope you understand this ties back in the context to what he just got done saying. And then in Leviticus chapter 25, again, he goes through some other things about sacrifices and different things that the priests were supposed to do and the type of animals. But if you go to chapter 25, he's going to talk about in chapter 25 use of land, how they were to use land, what they were supposed to do. This is years ago. This is back when I was growing up in church out there, and we were in a church that was predominantly farmers. Our church today is not predominantly farmers, but I grew up in a church seriously where probably 75% of the church was made up of farm families. Okay, and and remember talking about this one time, and one of the things that one of the farmers says is, I just don't know how you could just take a whole seventh year off. I mean, just letting your whole land not farming for a whole year. And I think they're missing the whole point. God was promising them, if you go through this, that if you kept that sabbatical year and you didn't farm for that year, God would make sure that you had enough crop in the sixth year to get you not only through that year, but into the through the seventh year and until your harvest in the first of the next year, which would be an eighth year from our perspective, but the first of the next set of seven. And then they had a double year like that, the 49th and 50th year, because the 49th was the seventh year, and then the 50th was on top of that, where they had a double Sabbath. And it was a matter, if you really understood that, it was a matter of understanding that God was guaranteeing if they would obey the law, God would give them this benefit. Now, one of the things, and I don't have this written down in here right now, and some of you have probably seen this, but one of the reasons God kicked Israel out of the land, out of Judah, and sent them into Babylon, was that the land might get its Sabbaths. In other words, for all the years they hadn't given the land its Sabbaths, God was going to make them stay in captivity that the land would get its Sabbaths. In other words, you haven't obeyed the law, so I'm going to force you to obey the law. You won't have a choice. You can't farm the land because you won't be here. And that's what God did. But again, that was different. Could you imagine all these other people that are kind of around that region, and they're watching, and you Jews, you people of Israel, Hebrews, people from the other side of the river. How come you don't farm? It's you farm every other year. What are you taking this year? Because our God told us to not farm on this year. You guys are nuts. What are you doing? Imagine if they see that God actually gave them an abundant crop in their sixth year and they weathered through all that. It would have been, had they done that, again, it would have been a testimony to God's faithfulness and God's power had they gotten that. Okay? Now, and then the last part of this that I have, and I actually have these verses marked here for you. Verse 35, and it says, "Now in the case of a countryman of yours becomes poor, and his means with regard to you falter, then you are to sustain him like a stranger or a sojourner, then he may live with you. But do not take usurious interest." In other words, they couldn't charge. You could charge interest to Gentiles, but the Jews were forbidden to charge interest to other Jews. But revere your God that your countrymen may live with you. You shall not give him your silver at interest, nor your food for gain. I am the Lord your God who brought you out. So he does this, and then we find down in the context that verse 39, that if the countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to you that he sells himself to you. In other words, I'm so at a loss, I'll be your slave. He says, "You shall not subject him to a slave service. He shall be like a hired man, as if he were a sojourner. He shall serve you, serve with you until the year of Jubilee." Your Jubilee would have been the 50th year. So, depending on how old you are, they may or may not live to that 50th year. But the point is, they brought him in, and God says you're going to treat them like a hired person, even though they're coming to you like a slave. You're not going to treat them like a slave. And that was important, because the people all around them, today we find slavery in our modern society, we find slavery very repugnant. Even I have to say, I probably, like most of you, I don't want to be a slave. I find it repugnant. And I think that's why most of us find it repugnant, because we're really put off with the fact, I don't ever want to be somebody's slave. I don't want to be told what to do, and I have no choice in the matter, and I don't get paid, and I just have to labor, and that person can treat. We don't like that, right? We don't want to be there, so we don't want other people to be there. But they lived in a world, and it's still true in many parts of the world today, slavery was common. It's common. And it wasn't just common that you just, like here in the United States, where we went and enslaved people that were from other parts of the country. In fact, before they started bringing in slaves into the South, where were a lot of slaves coming from into the colonies or over here into what became the United States? They were coming from England. They were called indentured servants. They were the same type of thing here. They were people that were so poor, had become so in debt, that the people that held their debt sold them to pay off their debts to other people over here in the States, and they sent them over here to work off their debt. And they were, but they were slaves. Called them indentured servants. But they were slaves, none the same. They understood that. They were working off a debt, very much like this. But God forbid, this is again, this is important, and God was making Israel different by telling them you can't have slaves of your countrymen. They work for you for this time, but they are not your slave. Yeah, they got their land back, and they themselves also were turned free at that time. Okay. So, let's kind of see. I'll kind of see where we're at here. See if I want to get down through. See if we can get through this next part. Leviticus 26. I'm just going to read these things off of here. But if you look in Leviticus 26, there were promises to these people now. If they obeyed, we have these promises given to us over in Deuteronomy 28. But we have the promises here that if they would do these things, notice chapter 26. Beginning with verse 3, if you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments so as to carry them out, then you shall have rains in your season so that the land will yield its produce and the trees of the field will bear their fruit. Peg and I went out and planted some more stuff in the garden last night. One of the things we're talking about is you have to kind of around here, you have to kind of check your stuff regularly because your sprinkler might not be hitting it. And you plant it and you come back 3 or 4 days and the sun burned it down and you might not get it to come back. That's happened to me before. I planted stuff. But they lived in a part of the world where it rained. And they got rains when they needed rains. And they didn't depend on irrigation like this. So you and I maybe don't appreciate this as well where we live. Got to live in Iowa where they really are rain dependent. Or live over in rain dependent country to the east here. And he says as a result, he said they would have the rains and they would have good agriculture. Verse 5, indeed your threshing will last for you until the grape gathering. The grape gathering will last until sowing time, and thus you shall eat your food to the full and live securely in your land. So they promised them that. Verses 7 and 8, he says, talking about their enemies, but you shall chase your enemies, and they will fall before you by the sword. 5 of you will chase 100, and 100 of you will chase 10,000, and your enemies shall fall before you again by the sword. Go in verse 9, he says, and so I will turn toward you, and I will make you fruitful and multiply. You and I will confirm my covenant so that they're gonna have healthy multiplied children. And then verses 11 and 12, and he tells them, moreover, I will make my dwelling among you, and my soul will not reject you. I will also walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. So we can see God promised them the blessing of successful agriculture, the blessing of peace with regard to both animals and enemies. Animals weren't going to terrorize them. The blessing of multiplied children and the blessing of God's presence in Israel. All of those were physical blessings that these people tangibly could see, tangibly could live with. It brings up interesting things when you understand that. We live in a culture today, if you have a husband and wife that get married and they never have children, for whatever reason, maybe they couldn't have children. We feel bad because they usually want children. Maybe they chose not to. But we don't, you know, we don't look at that like they did in their culture. But if you go back in their culture and understand that blessing, then you come over to like 1 Samuel, where you have Hannah that comes up before Eli, and she's mourning because her husband's other wife has children. She has no children, and she's just bitter. And she's up there praying, and she wants a child. Because she has none. Because in their culture, to not have a child implied that there was something wrong in your life. Because otherwise, God would be blessing you with multiplied benefits. So all of this is very tangible. Okay, all of this is very tangible under the law, what God is providing these people. And important. On the other hand, we could go into these and we could look at the other side of it. Disobedience and resulted in punishment. So there was lack of health. Your farms failed. You were overrun by your enemies. You were overrun by disease. And your children were overrun by disease. there's a, and I've got it. Did I give you the long list on there? Number one under B, 2B1, where it says cutting off. I'm just kind of curious because I see I don't have your sheet. I've got my note sheet here. Pardon me?
It just says
resulted in being cut off. There it is. Okay. Is there a list of scriptures behind that?
Yeah.
Okay. That list of scriptures is important. Because all those, that list is, that long list of scriptures there on, under number one, and we're not going to go through all those, but they're talking about being cut off. And I've given you some examples down below that cut off normally meant to be cut off by death. Death because of disease, death because of your enemies, death because your farm didn't do well and you starved to death, death even because of horrible, desperate acts that people would do to one another, in these cases, and even being cut off by being scattered among the nations. All of these things were forms of being cut off, but the significance of being cut off meant you were cut off from your people so that you no longer got to experience the blessings God had for you. God had promised blessings for these people, and because they were disobedient, they're cut off from those blessings. I'm jumping the gun on the last study with this that we'll touch on next week, but that's the difference under grace. Under grace, I as a believer can go out and I might do a real heinous sin. Heinous sin being something that everybody looks, oh! And in reality, I'm still not cut off from God's blessings to me in Christ because all those blessings are by grace. And if I can get myself cut off, then they're not by grace anymore. So it's a, there's a real difference. Israel earned their blessings. You and I can't earn our blessings, and we can't unearn them, obviously. But that's, we'll touch on that again next week when we come back. Okay, we ran through a lot of stuff tonight. We're going to come back, and I've got a little bit more next week that I want to touch on as we kind of move into some contrast and such. But we'll pick this up. But does anybody have any questions or comments here? It seems I hope it doesn't seem tedious to you to go through that. I think it's really valuable. I've said this before. I think there's a lot of people in Christendom that think the law's a good idea, you know. And that's what, I've heard a lot of people say that we're not under the law, but the law is still a good principle to live by, you know. Well, if you were under the law, yeah, then you ought to live by it. It's not just a good principle; it's what God demanded. But I think most people don't understand or appreciate what the law was really all about. And what we're trying to do tonight here really is give you a very brief survey of what it actually looked like to live under the law. You want to live under the law? This is the way you would have had to live. This is what that life was like. Okay? And there were a lot of restrictions. Restrictions on what you ate and what you could do and all the offerings that you had to bring and on and on and on. And there were promised blessings. A lot of people like the blessings, but on the other hand, people don't always like the curses. Okay? And remember, none of that's in effect. I'm going to say this. Some of you know what this is about. I'm not trying to be cruel or mean in saying this, but we had a believer here in this assembly quite a few years ago that I remember when I came out here to candidate, asked me what I thought about working on Sundays, and I said, well, some people, that's what they have to do. And he goes, no, it's wrong. God doesn't want us to work on Sundays. It's a Sabbath rule. And I said, well, you know, we're not really under the law. And he says, well, I decided to farm. He says, I had to work on a Sunday because I was behind. And so he says, I had some ground I had to cultivate. And he says, all the rows of beans that I cultivated that Sunday afternoon, they all did worse than every other bean in that field that season. He says, that was God's judgment on me for working on a Sunday. To this day, I don't know how to answer the guy what happened, but it wasn't God's judgment. It wasn't God's judgment because we're not under law. God does not have a Sabbath law and a Sabbath rule for people today. I thought that. I thought exactly that Satan could have actually manipulated circumstances to actually further produce superstition about Yeah, Satan. Satan sometimes can make things. Satan, let's put this. Satan can sometimes make being out of the will of God look very nice, and he can really decorate it well, and persuading us to go down that path. But
he was telling the whole story that he should have been doing something else that God had planned for him, and he's really balking at that.
Yeah. Yeah, see, that's the whole thing. I don't know if you could hear what Peggy was just saying up here, but Peggy was just saying unless there was something God wanted him to be doing with that time, instead of doing that, he went and did this other thing, and God taught him a lesson because he misused the time he had. I've had that happen. I've had times that I thought, oh, I've got a Bible study to get ready for, and so-and-so needs my time right now, but you know what? I'm going to go do this instead. And I go do that, and you know what? I've sat at my desk, and I've worked on a thing, and you want to... I tell my wife this sometimes. She goes, how'd it go in working today? And I said, I just felt like I was spinning my wheels. You ever feel like that? Like you're just spinning your wheels trying to get your job done? I find sometimes I spin my wheels because I'm not doing really what God wants me to be doing at that time. I know there's something he wants me to do, but in my mind, this has to be done. Instead of saying, hey, if that had to be done, God wouldn't have showed me something else he wanted me to be doing right now. Same. So God's, there's a lot of things we can set aside and come back and finish it up later.
Or he was so upset.
Yeah.
So upset about that, he really buggered it up.
Yeah.
In real life, he buggered it up.
Yeah. I was going to keep going with this, but that happened when I was in high school. I worked for my grandfather on the farm at different times. And I remember one time, the first time I ever cultivated for him, I'm out on the cultivator all day, and he goes off down to the South Farm, which is about 3 miles away, and I'm up there cultivating all day up there in his beans, and I'm going, after he's gone about a half hour, I'm going, it's going to take me forever to get done. I'm not going to finish these up this week. I'm going to be back up here cultivating these beans next week. So I just took the throttle and kicked it up a little bit. Now, you know, it's almost negligible, but you're thinking, this is pretty good. My grandfather comes up there for water break mid-morning and goes, you're going too fast. It's like, how in the world could you know? And I asked him, I said, how'd you know? You know, in my mind, I'm going, how did you know? But I asked for, how'd you know? And he goes, you're throwing too much dirt up against the beans. He could see, he's been doing this for all these years. He can see how much dirt the cultivator throws up against the beans, and he can tell that's more than they should have right now. He says, that's not good for them. So who knows? Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of different reasons why something like this could happen. Main point, we're not under law with regard to any of these things. And even if some of those things look like they might be good principles for us, you better find a New Testament scripture that tells you that that's what God wants you to do before you go and principalize these for Christian living. Because you probably get yourself into some trouble. Okay.
However, the New Testament does tell us that if that person thinks it's sin, then he shouldn't do it.
Yeah. And it might, and so that was a problem. If a person's going against their conscience, and at that time, whether he was going against his conscience or not, that I can't say. That I can't know. He was kind of testing the waters, I think, to try to see if, you know, this was okay because everybody was telling him he wasn't under law and such. And anyway, so, you know. Well, let's have a word of prayer. Father, again, we're thankful for the evening and the time you've given us together. And we are thankful for the law, because the law, as Paul says, does demonstrate that we are sinners and that we have a sinful nature that is contrary to you. And first, we're thankful for the fact that it proves that. But we are also thankful that we are not under that law as our way of life, as something that gives us the ability to approach you, but that we are under grace. And we are thankful for that, that it is not just a matter that we can do whatever we want, but that under grace you provided us benefits that we do not deserve and that we cannot lose. And that they're tied to who your Son Jesus Christ is and who you see us in respect, with respect to him. And we're thankful for that reality.